AM 1290. Stay tuned.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duva and are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. And you've recovered from your cold from last week?
I have, for the most part, which is great.
Yeah. Well,
how was your weekend?
My weekend was very interesting. I spent a lot of time with myself.
Your weekends are always action-packed.
It was fascinating.
Well, you know, I want to remind everybody, tomorrow is tax day. We all got a little break because Washington, D.C. has a interesting holiday. That's today. And so the taxes are all due tomorrow. So if you haven't filed yet, you got to get on that.
Actually, that is not necessarily true.
If you live
in Ventura or Santa Barbara, you got an extra 2 weeks. Apparently, if you live in our community, because of the catastrophes of January, the IRS has given us until April 30th to file our taxes.
That's right. So we all have a little cushion.
You're right.
But you're better to get it done tomorrow, and then you don't have anything to worry about for the rest of April.
Right, exactly. So, speaking of...
Before we get to the articles, let's introduce our guest.
We have a guest?
We do have a guest.
I thought it was
in
just
studio. You just thought it was me.
I thought we were just going to talk.
Today we have in studio with us Nicholas Miller, who is the Vice President of Sales and Marketing for the Bien Nacido and Solomon Hills Estate Wine Companies. Thanks for being here, Nicholas.
Thank you, Diane, for having me.
I was impressed with the fact that you were able to say that title.
Well, I kept getting, when I was typing it up, I kept getting all the words mixed up, but I got it. I think I got it right. Did I get it right, Nicholas?
Sounded good.
Good.
Very impressive. So the first article we have, it's a good article, but I would have picked it anyway because of the title.
I was just going to say, I think the thing you like most about it is the title.
Yeah, it's called Dr. Doom is Still Basking in His Fame. And the article is about Professor Rubini, who is a professor at NYU, who was one of the first and few voices that called the 2006, 2007, 2008 financial crisis. And
he had a lot of coverage during that time because he was one of the few that did call it. It's interesting, though, because when somebody gets known as Dr. Doom, they like to, sorry, I don't want to steal your thunder of the article, but revel in it and continue to call negative happenings that oftentimes don't happen.
Well, I have nothing else to say because you took away the punchline. So moving on. No.
You have another, though.
No, hold on. There's more here to Dr. Rubini. You're correct that he didn't stop. He was right, and he kept on saying the world is coming to an end, and the fact that the stock market's been up four times since the bottom of the financial crisis hasn't stopped him from continuing to believe that the world is coming to an end. And this was joined by another picture right below it in the Wall Street Journal this week of Meredith Whitney, who was the other star analyst who predicted the financial crisis, saying that the real estate market was overly heated up. And she then parlayed that into predicting that the municipal bond market would collapse, and it never did. And she's not answering telephone calls. They said in the article that they tried to get her comments for this article, and she refused to pick up the phone. And the reason that I picked this is that, in my view, that people who are right about something when everyone else is wrong usually don't repeat that success. And there's so much luck that takes place, and there's always going to be someone that's right. And so when you're right about something and money flows to you, it may be the time not to be following the success, because you end up, as we see statistically, that the majority of mutual fund investors over the last 100 years have done worse than the average mutual fund, because they get out of their fund when it does poorly and they get into the one that did well right before it does poorly.
Well, you know, in the industry, the disclaimer, past performance isn't a guarantee of future returns. Should be heeded.
Yes, and the next article actually is sort of related to that. And I knew from my days when I worked for a company that had a mutual fund that mutual funds were restricted to advertising using imagery that indicated that you were going to be successful. So you couldn't advertise your fund with a color of gold because it had implicit in it the sense that you were going to be successful. Well, for stocks, there's no such requirement. And the article in the Wall Street Journal talks about a company that is called, believe it or not, Safety Income and Growth Inc., which is a real estate investment trust that specializes in buying land leases. So the ticker symbol that they use is SAFE, S-A-F-E, an abbreviation of that title. So SAFE has this year been down, is down 9% while the market's up 10%. And the article is essentially saying that you've really got to be careful, because sometimes, and you know, there has been some, you know, behavioral science studies about people sometimes are influenced by things like names and colors and imagery, that just because it says it's safe, A, it may not be safe, and it may be misleading. And that's why in the case of mutual funds, they are restricted to what they can do. So don't buy SAFE just because you think it's safe.
Well, it's interesting to me that the SEC hasn't stepped in and created some sort of similar regulation regarding, you know, stocks as they do in the mutual fund world.
Well, the SEC is, based on what's going on in politics today, is beginning to basically withdraw from everything. There was an article, which I did not bring in yesterday, about Hank Greenberg, who was prosecuted under the Martin Act in New York, which prohibits fraud, and it's much stricter than federal rules, and he is 93 years old of him, is campaigning to get the law
repealed
because he didn't like the fact that you could be prosecuted for misleading. And, you know, there's a tendency now of people, not the markets up, to think that these regulations are hurting our economy. And, you know, history keeps repeating itself.
I know. It's somewhat, it's sad and shocking.
Well, and that goes to the next article, and that is that we would have thought after 2007 banks would not be involved in subprime lending. And if you look at the surface, it seems that that's true. But the front page of Friday's Wall Street Journal said that banks have hidden some subprime exposure. So, for example, Wells Fargo and Citicorp are unlikely to make a subprime credit score loan to a car buyer, but they're the biggest lenders to Exeter Finance. They lent $1.4 billion, who only does subprime lending to automobile buyers. So what you have here is banks not directly lending subprime, but lending to people who do lend subprime. So there is this sort of hidden exposure. They can say, we don't do it, but in fact, they are doing it through a third party.
My hope is, though, that the third party exposure will be limited to not be what it once was in 2007. But there's no guarantee of that.
Well, the issue is, as long as the economy is good, subprime lending will be okay because people will have a job and be able to pay their bills. But, the problem is that, you know, and this is what I don't get about banks. The typical loan to Exeter is at 3%. Exeter then turns around and lends the money to a subprime borrower at 15%.
Right. So they're not even being compensated to take on that excess risk.
Right. And so they say that in the article that the reason they think they're being compensated is because they're basically paying nothing for deposit money. And this is what they're using. They're using deposit money. They're paying, you know, 0.5% cost to get deposit money. So they're making, you know, 250 basis points. But to me, a 3%.
Yeah, but they can make 250 basis points off a traditional non-subprime loan.
Okay, well, the problem again is, again, this is not one of the articles I brought in, but the problem is that despite the tax cut, lending has not really picked up for banks. And so loan demand, and I'm not surprised because, you know, there was available interest rate, low interest rates for the last few years. And I don't think that the fact that you could get, that you have lower taxes is going to incentivize people to borrow and to build a plant or to get new equipment unless their business calls for it.
Such,
so,
right.
So you know, basically, banks need to put the money out. And so they're tempted, again, to do something like this. And the last article we have is one that I think we've talked about, but this was very explicit about when you have tariffs and you help one industry, you hurt another industry. And in the example in the New York Times this week was an article that showed a company in Pennsylvania, interestingly, that makes steel cylinders that are used for by the Navy and NASA that got its first bill for steel taxes, for steel tariffs, and the latest order for steel pipe that they took on Thursday was an extra $179,000, and they said they're really not going to be able to make it because it's just too high a price to pay.
Well, and I think what's important to point out is because they're having to buy American steel versus the Chinese steel.
And, you know, their customers are going to have to pay more if, in fact, their customers are willing to pay more. So it just flows through the system. So, again, this is one of the, you know, this is a real-world example of how tariffs aren't necessarily the panacea. It's time for a break. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Everybody buckle up. Buckle up. Buckle up. Buckle up.
Everybody
buckle up. Buckle up. Buckle up. Everybody buckle up.
Let's go.
Buckle up.
Can we go to the store?
Mom, can we get some ice cream?
Buckle up. Everybody buckle up.
Everybody buckle up.
A lot goes on in the car, but remember, you're in control. Stand firm. Only move when you hear the click that says they're buckled in. Never give up until they buckle up. Learn more at safercar.gov/kidsbuckleup. A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And we can be reached, if you have any questions, at 564-1290.
Or you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. And if you have any questions for our guest, Nicholas Miller, we'll be talking about the business of wine and his family's business, Bien Nacido. And so, Nicholas, thanks
Did he bring anything to drink?
I know. He didn't even bring us wine.
Very disappointing.
You can always pretend we have it in front of us, right? This is the radio.
Yeah, exactly. For all you listening, we're all swirling our
glasses. Let's pour out the Magnum.
So Nicholas, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you end up joining the family business?
Yeah, so I'm a part of the fifth generation of my family that's been involved in California agriculture. But as far as specifically how do I get involved with the family business, our family definitely has the mentality, and my dad made it known as I was growing up, is that there's no job waiting for us within the family business, is that it was very important for us.
And if you know Steve, you know that he actually did say that.
Right. Yeah, it's very important that you go off and go do something else to bring value back to the company. And so while growing up, I did work in the vineyard at spring break and during summer, and those were jobs were working out in the vineyard. I went to school on the East Coast and worked for a marketing consulting firm and just outside of Boston for several years before coming back in the early 2000s to then work with my family's business. And what it's been is it's really been a foothold in agriculture in general. Our family started off down in Ventura County.
It's such a cool story how you came to be. I'd love it if you'd share that.
Thank you, Diane. Yeah. So we started off growing lemons down in Ventura County and then later avocados. So most of our family's history has been involved out with orchard operations and later vineyard operations, but very much on the ag side, not so much the wine side. That's a more recent addition for us. In the late 60s, my dad, Steve Miller, and now late uncle, Bob Miller, wanted to expand beyond just lemons, avocados, orchards, which were really commodity business of you grow the fruit free of defect and go through a packing house. I wanted to look out for what other opportunities there were here on the Central Coast to be growing and perhaps looking at products that were more specialty products that they could have a little more control on. So in the late 60s, they identified two ranches, one in the northern part of Santa Barbara County, the Santa Maria Valley, and then a second ranch that was up in the Paso Robles area. And then very early on, in the early 70s, planted those both to grapes, which was a pretty novel idea at the time. What happened in this region is that post-Prohibition, really all the grapes went away. I don't think many people really focus on it today, but pre-Prohibition, the Center for Viticulture and Grapes in California was down in Los Angeles, actually, not the North Coast.
Really?
Yeah. So there were vineyards down in Los Angeles.
So where? I would think it would almost be too hot down there.
Well, it was a very different town than it is today.
Right.
Pre-Prohibition, yeah. I think there was very different approaches to viticulture of growing much more for quantity than necessarily what we think of as cool climate quality today. Fast forwarding to 1973, my dad and uncle planted grapes in these two sites, so one in Santa Maria Valley and then the other up in Paso Robles, and lucky for us, in subsequent generations, they got most of it right. They planted the stuff that did well in cool climate, i.e. Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in Santa Maria Valley, and then they planted the Cabernet, Merlot, Bordeaux varietals, Rhone varietals, Italian varietals up in Paso Robles where it is much warmer.
Interesting. Okay. So then from there, you know, your business model is very different than most vineyards. That as people think about a vineyard, most vineyard owners grow their grapes, bottle their grapes, and sell their wine. And there's very little, there's some cross-pollination, but certainly not as much as you've been really an industry leader in that type of selling your grapes, selling your fruit, as well as bottling. So can you share with us about that business model?
Certainly, yeah. So internally, our family often refers to ourselves as really having an upside-down pyramid of how we stack our family's assets, or really the reverse of how most people grow their exposure to the wine industry. Whereas I think the most common story is that a person starts their wine label and then kind of feeds the infrastructure to grow and scale that wine label. Our family story, as I said, start off in the vineyard. And still today, we grow more grapes. So we have our family grows grapes in both, as I was saying, the Santa Maria Valley in Santa Barbara County and up in Paso Robles, and sell most of those grapes to other wineries. So we grow more grapes than wine we make. We also make more wine than wine we bottle. So our smallest product of kind of those three steps of the process that we make, being finished case goods, is our smallest product still today. And it's our most recent that we've gotten into.
So how long have you been making?
So I first started making wine for our family in 2005 was the first vintage. In 2005, 2006, I made some wines from our family's estate vineyard. Bienesito that we just gave away from family and friends. So didn't sell them. And I learned the process, worked with several consultants that were already making wine from our family's vineyards. And then 2007 was the first vintage that we actually released commercially for sale. And then we run kind of a parallel pathway to that. And so we make our own wines, and our family's labels here locally include Jay Wilkes, which is a winery based on AVAs, so American Viticultural Areas. So instead of a single vineyard, focusing on several vineyards in the Santa Rita Hills, in Santa Maria Valley, in the Paso Robles Highland of regions.
Now, do you buy fruit for that, for those?
Some of those. Santa Rita being an example, we don't own any vineyards in the Santa Rita area. So we have relationships with growers that are there where we purchase the fruit from there. Smashberry is our family's red blend. It's a Paso red blend, mostly a Bordeaux red. And then Bower Lane is our Central Coast wine. And so we have our own, those are our own labels. But what we do even more of is we actually make control labels for other folks. So called exclusive wine, private label, control label. There isn't really one fixed term. But for example, here locally in Santa Barbara, we make the house wine. If you go to Stella or Cafe Stella, we make their Stella wine for them.
So you could make like a Neil and Diane labeled wine.
Well,
money talk.
Hypothetically, yes, and not really the business that we're in. It's kind of the we're not the place you come for a palate of wine or for kind of hobbyist wine. We want to scale to a little larger than that. The Stella example being one of the smaller ones we do here locally.
You don't know how much we drink.
Most of our orders need to start at about 1,200 cases. So
yeah, we can
try. A lot of friends.
Well, I think it's worth noting that you were also in 2013 named one of the top 40 under 40 tastemakers in America by Wine Enthusiast magazine. So that's a pretty tall accomplishment given how you haven't been necessarily bottling and making the wine as you are today for that long.
No, it was a huge honor. That was actually the first time they ever did it. So they've done it every year since then in the Wine Enthusiast. And
we've had some other... You're even a pioneer, Nicholas.
Lucky, right? Better to be lucky than smart. We've had other folks that are here in town that have been named on that list since then. And so it is really neat to see a national publication like Wine Enthusiast focus on Santa Barbara County and the folks that are really trying to make a difference and a name for ourselves here locally on a national platform.
And so, you know, what do you think most differentiates Bienesito from other vineyards or other wine producers in the state?
Yeah, so I think like most things in life, it was a time and a place, and my dad and uncle were there. I don't think Bienesito could be recreated today. Bienesito has this double offering that is not really reproduced anywhere else in the world, and that it's a sizable vineyard, that it has quite a bit of acreage planted to grapes, and it also is focused on the top quality initiative here in this county. And usually within the world of viticulture, there's that inverse tension that you kind of either choose quality or quantity. And so you've got the larger commercial vineyards really are focusing on trying to get high yields and be supplying quantity to the industry. And whereas at Bienesito, from the very beginning, we've always tried to separate ourselves as being the highest qualitative producer that we could, even at a larger scale. And so early on, our family were very early adopters of night harvesting, which is a qualitative choice to have the grapes come in firm where they're cooled off at night.
Explain to us that process. So, because right. It's pitch black up in the valley, you know, it's not like walking down, you know, the sidewalk. Here
we,
in Santa
we
Barbara.
We rent those, you know, football Friday night lights that we light up the vineyards. And the reason that we see an advantage to harvesting at night is that throughout the day, as the day warms up, the fruit itself will get softer on the vine. And so when you're picking that, you're putting it in the bin, the weight of grapes on grapes when they're a little softer can squish. And we have customers up in Napa, Sonoma, other states that they see that as a real qualitative advantage, that we can not only oftentimes have that fruit delivered to them before their local growers apply it to them, but because it's picked at night where the grapes are the firmest in the coldest, that they really hold up their integrity more while they're being delivered to the winery.
And one of the other benefits is that the workers probably appreciate it because it's cooler. And to work at night than it is in the daytime.
Absolutely, especially up in Paso Robles at that vineyard where we can have very large, we shut down, you know, midday.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Diane Duva with an invitation for you to enjoy a great dining experience at my favorite restaurant, the world-famous Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940. It's located on the corner of Olive and Coda Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. Arnaldi's specializes in traditional home-style Italian food, prepared with the freshest produce, finest quality meats and fish, and the very best imported Italian meats, cheeses, and olive oil, along with local fish and specials from our Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and an extensive wine list served in the unique atmosphere of a candlelit dining room. Arnaldi's also caters to weddings and rehearsal dinners, receptions, graduations, birthdays, holiday parties, or any special event, with two large dining rooms, a huge heated patio, fire pit, two bocce ball courts, and a stone barbecue with red oak wood. And Arnaldi's is happy to work with you to create a custom menu and handle any special requests. Visit arnaldis.com or call 805-962-5394.
Hospice of Santa Barbara is there to help when we're adjusting to living with a life-threatening illness, facing death, anticipating the death of a loved one, or healing our grief after a death. Hospice of Santa Barbara can provide the emotional, social, and spiritual care needed in a supportive, compassionate environment. Hospice of Santa Barbara provides professional counseling for individuals and has many support groups and programs for adults, teens, and children. Services are free, made possible by our community's generosity and by all of the highly trained, wonderful volunteers that give of their time to help those in need. If you would like to make a donation, become a volunteer, or support the important work of Hospice of Santa Barbara, or find out more about hospice services for you or someone you love, please call 563-8820, 563-8820, or visit our website at www.hospiceofsantabarbara.org.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial guidance. And we can be reached 564-1290. Nicholas, can we ask a political question? Because we haven't had any politics in the last 32 minutes.
God, you never know where this is going.
With the immigration issues, are you having problems finding people to pick wine, to pick grapes?
I mean, I think that's just a problem with California in general, right? Not necessarily localized with grapes or even agriculture. It's just that there is a change going on within California, and there's going to be an acute labor shortage that will continue to be an issue across hospitality, agriculture in general.
So you mechanizing is part of – there are, I guess, capital solutions to that problem, right? You can buy machinery to do it?
Absolutely. So our family's vineyard, French Camp, up in Paso Robles, has really been on the forefront of mechanization. We partnered early on with the University of Missouri, a professor that's back there, Justin Morris, and with a couple grants, and we're really early adopters of mechanization up there. So at this point, the French Camp vineyards up in the Paso Robles Highland is about 95% harvested mechanically. But for us, the process hasn't stopped there. We really tried to take it all the way back to mechanical farming in general, not just the harvesting process. And so for us early on, it was a remote vineyard, and so the decision was seeing that coming down the pipeline of there being a labor shortage and just getting people out there remotely. But one of the great side effects is that we've really seen a qualitative advantage to mechanizing as well.
Oh, that's interesting. I was going to ask, do you notice a difference? And what type with that shift, what superior product are you able to – what are the differences basically?
Sure, yeah. And so I think one of the great byproducts of going towards mechanization is having much more consistent harvest year in and year out. So the vintages kind of tend to mirror each other more closely than the variation of hand farming. And one of the reasons for that is it becomes a little bit more of a mechanical calculation in that you're choosing to leave how many buds on each vine through this mechanized process instead of kind of the random chance of what looks good and what not. And so early on at our family's winery up in Paso Robles, the Paso Robles Wine Services, we did a lot of side-by-side testing of hand harvest versus mechanized harvest. And certainly a lot of the bigger red varietals, Merlot being the best example I think of, we actually came to prefer the qualitative output of the mechanization versus the hand-harvested fruit up there. That said, it's a totally different game in Santa Maria. We have steep hillsides there that
will
probably
never be
mechanized. Yeah, or at least not in the foreseeable future. So it all depends on how you're set up as well. I do believe mechanization is the future of viticulture here in California, and that even apart from economics that a lot of people like to pigeonhole into as well, you just want to save money, right, by mechanizing. Well, as you brought up, there are other factors as well. It's not just trying to save money in the vineyard. There will be a labor shortage that will continue to increase, and it's just going to be what happens here in California. And so we're very fortunate that our families tried to get ahead of the ball and really adopt mechanization. But we've seen that happen in other countries, Australia, in France, where they just don't have the labor, so you're forced to go to mechanization. We want to be out there owning it as opposed to being forced into it at a future date.
From a macroeconomic standpoint, people's tastes change. So, 15 years ago, beer was putting hard liquor out of the business. Now beer companies are in trouble and hard liquor's coming back. Where is wine on a secular basis today, and is there some cyclicality in wine consumption that you need to plan for?
Yeah, no, I think consumption in general is something that stumps a lot of people, because we see these trends where it goes up and down, and what I think the best thing I've ever seen it linked to is that consumption kind of follows population growth, right? And we like to market our way into trying to break that cycle, but the baby boomers were great consumers because there were a lot of them, right? And as those have worked through the system, I think there's a little bit of doubt of who will backfill those drinkers in the future. I think the good news for wine, when you compare it to other consumable products, beverages such as liquor and beer, is that it's marketed, I think, of the three, more like a food than a beverage, being set up with a dinner table. As being part of a meal, that's not necessarily as interchangeable as
the pre-meal cocktail.
Pre-meal cocktail, right? But a beer, right? That's a refreshing. I think someone on at a barbecue on a hot Sunday afternoon could maybe go for cider, beer, cocktail, kind of more interchangeably than if you're having salmon and vegetables at home, you want a nice glass of Pinot Noir. So for us here in Santa Barbara County on the Central Coast, of kind of where we live, I think we're in a little better position with the wine, in that we're not the lowest end pricing of California Appalachian that's a pure commodity, and that I'm a little more nervous about that side of the industry, that becomes more interchangeable with just alcohol, right? Whereas we're really a specialty product here in Santa Barbara County that needs to be thought of as a luxury product.
Well, and Pinot Noir, since the movie Sideways, has become almost like a synonym to Santa Barbara County. It's just what people think of when they think about wine coming from this area or this region. And so what would you say your percentages of international versus domestic consumption? How much international product do you ship? What does that do to your numbers and affect your business?
So we don't ship a lot. We don't export a lot. Probably under 10% of our family's wines that go abroad. Our biggest market being Canada, but over the last several years with the currency fluctuation, as we've pulled so far ahead of Canada, it's really hurt that export business.
For a while there, China was a big player. Everyone was talking about how the Chinese market, once it opened to wines, they were importing a ton of wine. Did you experience any of that growth? Because then I heard it contracted as well.
We've shipped wine too. And so China kind of has two different markets. Even though it all goes through Hong Kong, there's Hong Kong and mainland. So we've sold wine to both areas. I've never gone over there to personally market it. So for us, it's been more relationship with an importer as you want. That said, we haven't seen China as necessarily our first dollar spent on where we want to export there, because we're not as competitive for that. What we get asked for all the time is, make me a Napa Cabernet for $5 a bottle. Everyone wants that, right?
And that's right. But,
yeah, if you made that, yes, you could sell a ton of wine in China. But as far as the Bienesito state label, we're making $60 to $100 bottles of wine. We haven't had... First of all, the Bienesito and Solomon Hills wines are all allocated and kind of, they already moved through our system anyways. but we haven't pushed that the luxury item into China as much. The wines that we have shipped there tend to be our Central Coast labels, our Bower Lane, and so those are very price dependency, right? And so the current talks of tariffs will probably make that not viable to go to China. As an international market, wines kind of become much more interchangeable in a global environment. And in this last year, Australia finally passed France as being the number one importer into China. Well, that's a little scary from, I think, California perspective, because I think Australian wines mirror more of the California style, of that more fruit-forward, richer style than the old world.
France, or who knows, they could drinking. Just be opening their palate for California to then come in behind.
Right. Well, I mean,
with a more refined, higher price point.
Well, and without 20% tariffs, right? That's right. You know, that's my point, is that with, you know, we're behind, right? If Australia has, they're already in proximity closer, right? The tariffs can.
Now, how much do you export to Europe at all?
A little bit. One of our best relationships on the Bienocido Solomon Hills is with an importer into England, in the UK, especially London. I mean, that's like every major city does. They'd really like to see themselves as the international wine market. But probably in my own personal travels, they are more so than anywhere else, than like a New York or San Francisco, that still can favor domestic wines here. That's our strongest market for our Bienocido and Solomon Hills wines.
And, you know, speaking of New York, I know when I go there and I look in a store, I find it really shocking that French wines are significantly less costly than California wines, which is really unbelievable if you think about the transportation costs and, you know, the tariff costs, and, but whatever the... I don't understand why that. Do you have any idea why that?
I think in general, wines from France have really been bifurcated into Bordeaux. There's the first growth, the second growth. Those prices have gone to the stratosphere, and so you're not going to see those in the local store there in New York. Whereas the rest of Bordeaux has not had the good times that have followed behind that. So you've gotten the kind of the wines that have stayed stagnant with price, then you've got the luxury items that just continue to go up.
Should I be insulted that you accuse me of going to stores in New York that wouldn't have the best wines? I'm very sensitive, and I
think you actually told the world that's what you were doing. You were going to look for French wines, not California wines.
No,
York,
I was just noticing.
Stores,
no,
right?
No, I was just noticing.
You're picking the wrong store
to
go to.
It's time to take a break. you've been listening to, and continue to listening to, I hope, Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Not completing high school is more of a social thing than it was an academic thing. I came out in the 11th grade. Nobody was embracing you. The kids were cruel. It was very difficult to be gay. Even though all these years have passed, I still had that longing to have my diploma.
The hard part was determining that I was going to do it, but I definitely didn't do it alone.
At age 30, with the help of her mentor, Carissa finished her high school diploma.
I have a mentor, Maria. She convinced me to continue my education and to finish what I started to get my diploma. Just never judges. She's a true role model. If you're even considering getting your high school diploma, go get it. You can do it.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
And if you're just joining us, we're in studio with Nicholas Miller, the Vice President for Sales and Marketing for Bien Nacido and Solomon Hills wineries. And so, Nicholas, you've been very involved with Santa Maria Valley Agriculture and really been a pioneer in getting a coalition together up in North County. Share with us a little bit about what that's like and what the agricultural industry up in Santa Maria is like.
Santa Maria is very interesting that way in that we have this population base that really attracts people to South County. Agriculture all exists in North County, right. So while we're one county, we really are two separate worlds of what we're dealing with, South County and North County. But I think what the biggest disconnect is that most counties that are so reliant on agriculture, like we are here in Santa Barbara County, I think it's our biggest industry, isn't it, in the county?
I think it is, yeah.
Is that most counties that are so dependent on ag celebrate ag, and that's where they send people, and that's what they tell is kind of the story of their area. Whereas Santa Barbara, we have such a huge attraction to South County. That's really where a lot of the attention is put on image of displaying what the image is of Santa Barbara, of the waterfront, of downtown
State
Street.
Well, I do think hospitality is the number one people come here for tourism. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what we produce, I would say it's ag.
But I think in most places those are much more integrated.
Yes,
where ag is big. Whereas in Santa Barbara County, there's as you made that distinction, there's hospitality in South County and agriculture in North County. And it is a big disconnect for Santa Barbara. And that I think a lot of people in South County, where the political base continues to rest, aren't necessarily aware of issues that they're facing North County, aren't aware of what's needed for sustainability, ongoing operations happening in agriculture in North County. And so I think for the most part, a lot of folks that are farming in the northern part of this county feel like they don't necessarily have the same voice that necessarily such a strong industry would enjoy in another area.
I feel like you've really been, though, instrumental in bringing together that North County. You know, you do a good job at straddling both South and North County. And so you've done a good job at kind of rallying a representative group of agriculture up in North County. And how did you do that? And what changes are you hoping to accomplish by getting that unified voice up for ag?
So specific to the wine industry, about, I don't know, it was 10 or 15 years ago, we put together Santa Maria Valley Winery Association to try to really promote that area in particular. And really what it came down to is just we were too small on our own. And so what we did is coming together with Santa Barbara County Vintners and is really trying to leverage the voice and power of our region magnified through a larger association with the Santa Barbara County Vintners. So specific to wine, I think we've got a great voice now. We've got a new executive director at the Santa Barbara County Vintners Association. Actually came from outside the industry. Her background was really with kind of groups, systems, social work that I think she's going to do a great job of pointing our Vintners Association in a new direction. As far as agriculture in general, I think we still lack a lot of the infrastructure to really have a unified voice. Certainly, we've got Farm Bureau here in Santa Barbara County, but agriculture, even as an industry, is really segmented between you've got the wine industry, you've got the annual crops with vegetable growers, and you've got the berry guys, and they're all competing, which is pretty rare in an area that grows world class grapes. Most areas where you're growing, where you're finding vineyards, really see that as the highest and best use for that land. Whereas here in Santa Barbara County, there really are viable alternatives, and there's competition between places to plant vegetables, places to plant strawberries, places to plant grapes. And so I think what we've really all rallied around as an industry is kind of the adversity of the challenges that agriculture has faced here in Santa Barbara County. And so two of the big ones that are not unique to this area but are in really hate to use desperate term or desperate times, but we are facing that is with water.
Water, yeah.
So the drought has not ended here. You have all this press in Northern California with recharge of reservoirs saying the drought's over. It's not. I mean, we're still in a zone here that we need to be careful. And then labor, as we talked about earlier, it's not looking like a bright future right now.
Right. And how do you deal with the with that challenge that we're facing with water? And it is a serious consideration. What do you do? Do you have wells on property?
We do. So we're very blessed. Bienvenido is on top of an aquifer where we're bringing water up, and we've had some great recharge vents. We're not on state water. Some of these stories that you hear, especially with growers in the interior valley of California over in the San Joaquin Valley, they're all dependent on the allocations that they get. Fortunately, we're not right now. However, let's bring this back to the money show, right? Of kind of the good advice I get to leave with before we leave, that if you want your children to enjoy full-time employment for the rest of their life here in California, I think the three careers I would choose would be go into HR.
I think that's a national one right. These days.
Be a labor attorney or a water attorney, right? Go into water law and you will. As Mark Twain, right, said that whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over. It's that time is coming right now.
Right. And so, you know, I view that your role is really being relationship-based, and you do such a great job with that, Nicholas. How have you been able to parlay that into those relationships that you created as you sell your grapes to? There are many wineries in town that I thought Bienvenido was their winery because they always have your name on all of their labels. Mm-hmm. How do you foster and maintain those relationships?
And I used to think that networking was all about kind of who collects the most wins, right? I think that's what a lot of social media is aimed at today. It's kind of a miseducation of what that tool can be. But it was very recently that I came across someone that said something that's really resonated with me, and I think is the most important perspective when it comes to coalition building, marketing, taking care of your customer base, is that it's not important to have lots of relationships. It's important to have really deep, meaningful relationships. And meaningful is what I really want to underline there, in that having lots of people that you have their phone number does you a lot less good than having really strong relationships where they'll return your call or pick up your call when you call them, right? Business isn't about what other people can do for you. It's what you can do for them. And so I think what we've been really blessed at Bienvenido is to build these relationships with folks that want to be partnering with us, right? That they buy into what we're trying to do as a family is really be on the forefront of quality. And in turn, they're going to have that partnership where they put our family's wine vineyard name on their wine label. So today, Bienvenido is the most vineyard-designated vineyard in the world, meaning most amount of wineries that are out there that have a single vineyard designation on the bottle.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing.
Hi, I'm Diane Duva with an invitation for you to enjoy a great dining experience at my favorite restaurant, the world-famous Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940. It's located on the corner of Olive and Cota Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. Arnaldi's specializes in traditional home-style Italian food prepared with the freshest produce, finest quality meats and fish, and the very best imported Italian meats, cheeses, and olive oil, along with local fish and specials from our Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and an extensive wine list served in the unique atmosphere of a candlelit dining room. Arnaldi's also caters to weddings and rehearsal dinners, receptions, graduations, birthdays, holiday parties, or any special event, with two large dining rooms, a huge heated patio, fire pit, two bocce ball courts, and a stone barbecue with red oak wood. And Arnaldi's is happy to work with you to create a custom menu and handle any special requests. Visit Arnaldi's.com or call 805-962-5394.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Nicholas, let's dig in and if you would, share some information about your wineries and also share with us where we could purchase some of your wine if we wanted to.
Great. Thank you, Diane. Yeah, so the wines that I first started making for my family were the Bienestito and Solomon Hills Estate wines. As we talked about earlier in the show, first vintage was 05, and I made those wines up until the 2010 vintage.
And how did your family decide to fire you as the winemaker and get somebody else in? That's what I want to know.
No, that was my own decision that supported by my family, is that I was able to hire a gentleman by the name of Trey Fletcher, who was at one of my favorite wineries for making Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in California. His name is Trey Fletcher. He was up at Litterai on the Sonoma Coast. Litterai is owned by a gentleman named Ted Lemon, who was the first American to ever run a domain in Burgundy. Well, Trey had experience and was making wines that were such a strong caliber that I look back at my time as a winemaker, and I was taking really great grapes and making good wine, whereas having the talent of Trey to recruit him to come down here and take on our family's wine, he now took great grapes and is making great wine, and really being rewarded from that by critics, by consumers. Last year, Antonio Galloni, who I think is really the future as the wine critics kind of losing their power, he's the voice that's really starting to rise above the fray, and he's building an online, not just a wine site, but really wine media site. So in his review of our area last year, of his top 10 wines, we were there three or four of his top 10. And then last year, I also brought on a gentleman by the name of Will Costello, who's a master somm out of Las Vegas, to be our brand ambassador. And so between the two of them, Trey and Will, they're doing just such a great job with the Bienestito and Solomon Hills wines that it's kind of hard to find them now, right? Because most of them, they get allocated by release, get pulled through the system. Really, your best chance is to go up to our family's tasting room that's up in Los Olivos, the Bienestito and Solomon Hills, right there on the main street of Los Olivos. And so for us, that's been a great new step our family has taken, in that it's given us a direct connection with our consumer. So much of the wine our family makes for the private label or for some of our larger labels, our strongest relationships are with our distributors, our sales force. Bienestito and Solomon Hills is such a smaller, intimate project that we've really been able to connect more with our direct consumer.
Now, at the tasting room, are you able to join the wine clubs?
Yes. Yeah. So we have a wine club for the Solomon Hills, the main wines of the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir from Solomon Hills, the Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Syrah from Bienestito. And then we'll be releasing this fall our Pillars allocation, which is our reserve wines on top of that. And those, I think the Pinot Noir got like a 97 from Galloni last year.
Oh,
only available,
great. Congratulations.
Only available there at the tasting room, not in... you won't be able to find it in distribution.
So if the wine business has a weak period, one of the things that your family can get into is marriage counseling, because you have been in the family business for five generations, and what happens with family businesses, it usually lasts at the most three generations because people stop getting along. So you must have the secret not only of winemaking, but the secret of getting along with family
and
members.
And I can vouch for them. The Miller family is one of the most wonderful families that I know, all of them.
Well, thank you, Nicholas, for being here. I think I have to go out and have a drink now. you've been listening to Money Talk, and thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.